Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Look, I know exactly what your feed looks like right now. It is probably just wall-to-wall coverage of the latest agent update.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Or, you know, the newest model that can code an entire app in like 6 seconds. It's everywhere.
Right, it's everywhere. We are also completely obsessed with the last 3 or 4 years. But today, I actually want to try something a little different. I want to zoom out. Way out.
Which is honestly about time. If you only look at the post-2022 explosion, you're missing the entire plot. It's like, well, it's like seeing the season finale without watching the 75 seasons that came before it.
Exactly. So for you listening, we are looking at a 76-year timeline today. We are going back to a time before silicon chips, before the internet, before anyone had even uttered the words artificial intelligence.
We're starting in 1950.
1950 with a British mathematician named Alan Turing. Now, most people probably know him as the guy who cracked the Nazi Enigma codes, right?
Right, the war hero, the genius. But in 1950, he did something that was arguably a lot more dangerous than cracking a code.
Dangerous how?
Well, he published a paper where he asked a really simple forward question. He asked, can machines think?
Wow. I mean, it sounds so innocent to us now, but back then, that must have been absolute heresy.
Oh, it was worse than heresy. It was considered totally absurd. It challenged the very definition of human intelligence and exceptionalism. But, and here is the absolute genius of Turing, he knew that thinking is a trap.
Right, because how do you even define thinking?
Exactly. It's a philosophical black hole. You can argue forever about whether a machine has a soul or, you know, consciousness. So Turing basically said, forget the philosophy. Let's look at the behavior.
And this is where we get the famous Turing test. Well, I think most people have heard of it, but how did he actually set it up as a practical answer?
He proposed a game. You have a human judge sitting at a screen, and they are chatting with two hidden entities. One is a human and the other is a machine.
Just typing back and forth.
Right, just text. And if the human judge cannot tell which is which, after 5 minutes, the machine wins, it passes the test.
I've always loved this concept because it feels like a sleight of hand. He completely sidestepped the impossible question of, is it alive? And just replaced it with, can it fool you?
He really did. He shifted the entire metric of intelligence from internal thought, which is completely invisible, to observable performance. And here's the real kicker. Turing made a prediction.
Okay.
He said that by the year 2000, machines would be able to fool about 30% of humans in a 5-minute conversation.
30% by the year 2000. We will definitely circle back to whether he was right or wrong about that exact timeline. But that single question, can machines think, kicked off a journey that brings us all the way to 2026.
A very long, very bumpy journey.
Yes. And spoiler alert for anyone listening right now, this is absolutely not a straight line of progress.
Not at all. It is a story full of arrogance, catastrophic failures, entire decades where funding just froze up, and a small group of really stubborn outcasts who just refused to quit.
So let's go to the official birth of all this. We are moving from 1950 to the summer of 1956 at Dartmouth College.
This is the moment. You have four young, incredibly bright scientists, John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, Claude Shannon, and Nathaniel Rochester.
Heavy hitters.
Absolute legends of the field. They organized the summer workshop, and they actually coined the term artificial intelligence right there.
And from what I read in the source material, their ambition was, well, let's just call it extremely optimistic.
That is putting it incredibly mildly. They literally wrote a formal proposal stating that if they got 10 scientists together for 2 months, just one summer, they could make a significant breakthrough in making machines use language, form concepts, and solve problems reserved for humans.
2 months. They thought they could solve human intelligence in a summer camp.
They really did. They thought it was basically just a matter of writing down the right logic. They underestimated the problem on a scale that is honestly hard to comprehend today, but that sheer arrogance kicked off what we now call the Golden Age.
This was roughly 1956 to 1974.
Right. And during that time, the government and the military just poured massive amounts of money into this research. The optimism was completely unlimited. They were totally convinced we have a human-like robot walking the dog by, like, 1980.
And they did build some things that at least looked like AI.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Eliza from 1966. This was the first chatbot, and it pretended to be a psychotherapist.
Yes, Eliza is a perfect case study in what we call the illusion of intelligence. You would sit down and type, I'm feeling sad, and the machine would reply, why are you feeling sad?
And then you'd type, well, my boyfriend is mean to me.
And it would say, tell me more about your boyfriend.
People actually fell for this, didn't they? I remember reading a detail where some of the staff in the lab were asking the creator to leave the room so they could have private emotional conversations with the machine.
They really did. People projected this deep, profound empathy onto it. But the underlying code, it was barely a page long. It was just a parlor trick.
So it wasn't actually understanding anything.
Not a single thing. It just scanned for keywords like mother or sad and mechanically plugged them into pre-written sentence templates. It didn't know what a mother was. It didn't experience sadness. It was essentially just rearranging words and mirroring the user.
It's a smart parrot problem.
Exactly.
Around the same time, you had other projects too, like SHRDLU, which, side note, is a terrible name for a piece of software.
Yeah.
And Shaky the robot.
Oh, Shaky is an absolute legend in the field. From around 1966 to 1972, it was the first mobile robot that could actually reason about its own actions and plan a route.
And I love this detail. It was called Shaky because it physically shook when it moved.
It literally trembled as it calculated its next move. But Shaky, along with SHRDLU, revealed the first major wall that AI hit.
The micro-world problem.
Right. These systems only worked in what we call microworlds. SHRDLU lived in a perfectly clean virtual world of colored blocks. Shaky lived in a stark, artificially empty room with specially painted baseboards, just so its cameras could figure out where the floor met the wall.
So they worked great in a highly controlled lab environment. But if you took Shaky and put him on a messy, real-world street corner,
complete collapse. They couldn't handle ambiguity at all. If the lighting changed by 10% or a random shadow moved across the floor, Shaky was completely lost.
Because the real world is messy.
Exactly. This is the fundamental difference between pure logic and reality. Real life is chaotic, and these early machines demanded absolute perfection.
And eventually, the people writing the checks figured this out. When the government realized they had spent millions of dollars over decades for a shaking robot and a digital parrot that just repeated your words back to you, the checkbook closed.
It slammed shut. And this brings us right to 1973 and 1974. In the UK, Sir James Lighthill publishes this devastating report that basically says, this is all hype. The progress is a mirage. None of this is actually useful.
And that triggered the first AI winter.
It was essentially an extinction-level event for AI researchers. Funding was aggressively cut, major projects were shut down, and researchers fled the field. If you walked into a university computer science department in 1975 and proudly said you were working on artificial intelligence, people would actually laugh at you.
You had to rebrand it, right?
You had to call it machine learning or pattern recognition just to have a chance at getting a grant. It was a dark time.
But as with any good history, during this dark time, there was an underground resistance.
A very small, very stubborn resistance.
People like Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, and Yoshua Benjo. We are going to hear those names again. But while everyone else abandoned the ship, they kept working quietly on a concept called neural networks, simulating the brain. But we will table them for just a minute because the mainstream field did eventually make a comeback in the 1980s.
Yes, from roughly 1980 to 1987, AI woke up from the winter by executing a massive pivot. Instead of trying to simulate a human brain, the industry decided, let's just code the rules.
The era of expert systems.
Precisely. The logic here was that human intelligence is really just possessing a massive amount of specific knowledge. So if we want a machine to act like a doctor and diagnose blood infections, we sit down with the best doctor in the world and we just ask them, how do you do it?
And the doctor says, well, if the patient's fever is over 101 and if they have a specific rash, then I check for bacteria X.
Mm.
So it's literally just if-then statements.
Thousands and thousands of if-then statements based on expert knowledge. And the crazy thing is, for a little while, it worked incredibly well.
The sources mentioned a system called MyCIN.
MyCIN was a huge success story. It had about 600 rules, and it actually diagnosed specific blood infections better than many general practitioners. Then there was XCON, which automatically configured complex computer systems for the DEC Corporation. It saved them millions of dollars.
So the money comes rushing back in. Corporations are suddenly buying these specialized Lisp machines that cost anywhere from $70,000 to $150,000 each just to run these massive rule books. Japan launches a multi-billion dollar fifth generation computer project. Feels like the golden age is back. But I am guessing there is a fatal flaw here.
There were three fatal flaws, actually. First was hard maintenance. Medicine and business constantly change. If science updated a single medical protocol, a programmer had to go in and manually rewrite thousands of interconnected rules. It was impossible to keep up.
And the second slow.
Poor scalability. The more rules you added, the slower and more bloated the system became. But the third flaw was the real killer.
Brittleness.
Brittleness, meaning they break easily.
Meaning they have absolutely zero common sense. Imagine you build an expert system robot to make coffee. You painstakingly code every step. Grind beans, boil water, pour water. Sounds great. But one day you run out of coffee beans. A human would see the empty bag and stop.
What does the rule-based robot do? The robot happily boils the water and pours it directly onto the empty counter because nobody explicitly programmed a rule for what to do if the grinder is empty. Anything outside the exact rules caused total failure.
So by the late 80s, the market crashes again. PCs are getting cheaper, which completely kills the market for those expensive list machines. Japan's massive project fails.
And we enter the second AI winter, from 1987 to about 1993.
Which brings us back to our underground resistance. Hinton, LeCun, Bengio. While the expert system model was collapsing, they were still quietly pushing the idea of neural networks.
Yes, the paradigm shift that changed everything.
Explain neural networks simply, just to contrast it with the expert systems.
The expert system is like a rigid recipe. Add two eggs, stir for 1 minute. If you forget to write down, crack the eggs first, the system breaks.
Right.
A neural network is totally different. It is like teaching a child to ride a bicycle. You don't hand a child a textbook on the physics of gravity and angular momentum. You just put them on the bike. They try, they fall down, the brain takes in that data and it adjusts. They try again.
So you aren't programming the rules anymore. You are letting the system learn the rules from raw data.
Exactly. But throughout the 80s and early 90s, the broader AI community treated this idea like a joke. They said it was a dead end. But the researchers kept grinding. And slowly, the tide started to turn.
We see flashes of it in the 90s. In 1997, IBM's Deep Blue defeats Garry Kasparov at chess.
Though we should note, Deep Blue was mostly brute force. It was calculating 200 million positions a second. It wasn't really learning in the modern sense, but it was a huge psychological turning point.
And then in 1998, Jan LeCun successfully uses a neural network for handwriting recognition, the MNICAST dataset. Banks actually started using it to read the numbers on handwritten checks. That was the first real commercial success for neural nets.
And then in 2006, Jeffrey Hinton publishes a paper proving that you can actually train deep, multi-layered neural networks effectively using a technique called pre-training.
Setting the stage for 2012, the Big Bang.
2012 is the year the history of the world permanently changed, the ImageNet competition.
Okay, set the scene for us. This is a massive visual recognition competition, right?
Right. Teams compete to have their software look at millions of images and accurately say, this is a cat, this is a toaster, this is a boat. For years, teams using the old statistical methods would improve their accuracy by maybe 1% a year. It was agonizingly slow.
Until a team from Hinton's lab shows up.
Led by his student, Alex Krajewski, they entered a deep neural network called AlexNet.
And they absolutely shattered the record.
Smashed them. Huh. They beat the second place team by a margin that nobody thought was mathematically possible. It proved, once and for all, that if you build a deep enough neural network, it can actually see.
But the underlying math for neural networks had been around for decades. Why did it suddenly work in 2012?
Because of what we can call the why now trinity. Three distinct ingredients finally collided at the exact same moment.
Number one being data.
Right. Thanks to the internet, we finally had billions of digital images and text documents to feed the networks. They learned by example, and suddenly we had infinite examples.
Number two is algorithms.
Yes, new mathematical techniques. Things like dropout and ReLU, which finally allowed these deep networks to train without getting stuck or overloading.
And the third ingredient, because this is the one that always blows my mind.
Hardware. The physical chips. So the CPU in your standard laptop is kind of like a Ferrari. It is incredibly fast, but it only carries one passenger at a time. It does one complex task linearly. But a neural network doesn't need a Ferrari. It needs to do millions of tiny, simple math problems simultaneously.
It needs a massive fleet of garbage trucks.
Exactly. And it turned out a piece of hardware already existed that acted exactly like a fleet of garbage trucks. The GPU, the graphics processing unit.
Video game graphics cards.
Teenage gamers wanted incredibly realistic lighting and water physics in their video games. To render that, a chip has to calculate the color of millions of pixels on the screen all at the exact same time. It just so happens that rendering a pixel is the exact same type of parallel math needed to fire an artificial neuron.
So Alex Krizhevsky didn't use a supercomputer.
He used two NVIDIA GTX 580s. He bought them off the shelf, the exact same cards you'd buy to play Call of Duty, and he repurposed them for AI.
That is wild. We literally owe the modern AI revolution to the video game industry.
100%. If gamers hadn't driven NVIDIA to build cheaper, faster GPUs, this whole timeline might have been delayed by another 10 or 20 years.
And once that dam broke in 2012, the acceleration was terrifyingly fast. By 2014, we had JANS networks competing against each other to generate hyper-realistic fake images. In 2016, Google's AlphaGo defeats the world champion at the game of Go.
Which was a massive deal because the board game Go has more possible complex states than there are atoms in the observable universe. You cannot brute force it like Deep Blue did with chess. AlphaGo had to actually develop an intuition.
But the leap that brings us directly to today, to the chatbots and the agents, happened in 2017.
The Google paper. Attention is all you need.
That is the paper that introduced the transformer architecture. How did transformers change the game?
Before 2017, an AI read text a lot like a human reading a scrolling ticker tape. It read one word at a time, strictly in order. The problem was, by the time it got to the end of a long paragraph, it had essentially forgotten what the first sentence was about.
It had terrible short-term memory.
Exactly. The transformer architecture changed that by allowing the model to look at the entire context at once. It uses an attention mechanism. It can look at the word bank in a sentence and instantly know it means a financial institution, not a riverbank, because it is simultaneously paying attention to the word deposit located 15 words later.
And the transformer is the T in GPT, generative pre-trained transformer.
Right. It scaled beautifully. By 2020, OpenAI releases GPT-3 with 175 billion parameters. It wasn't just predicting text anymore. It was starting to write functional code and perform basic reasoning.
Which leads us directly to the explosion. November 2022, the release of ChatGPT.
The fastest growing consumer application in the history of the world. 1 million users in 5 days.
Why did it explode like that? AI was already around.
Because it suddenly became completely accessible to the average person. It wasn't a research paper, it was a chat box. And more importantly, people realized almost instantly that it wasn't just another Eliza. It wasn't a trick, it was an actual reasoning engine.
From there, the models just kept coming. GPT-4 brought advanced multimodal vision. Anthropic gave us Claude, introducing constitutional AI and massive context windows so you could upload whole books. Google released Gemini as a native multimodal system.
The progress curve basically went vertical.
Which brings us to where we are right now. We're sitting here in early 2026, and the paradigm has shifted again. We are officially in the age of agents.
Yes, and this is a crucial distinction for people to understand. A chatbot is reactive. You talk, it responds. An agent is proactive.
It takes action.
Exactly. You don't just chat with an agent. You give it a high-level goal. You say, research the housing market in Chicago, find me 3 properties under budget, and draft an email to the realtors.
And it goes off and does it. It opens a browser. It uses APIs. It navigates websites. It writes code to scrape data. It executes multi-step workflows autonomously.
We have far exceeded Alan Turing's prediction. He thought 30% of people would be fooled for 5 minutes. Today, these models can mimic human reasoning and hold deep, context-aware conversations for hours.
But doing this, especially locally, requires some serious hardware. For you listening who are trying to run these agents at home, avoiding the cloud for privacy reasons, you know the reality of the hardware market right now.
It all comes back to the GPUs again. But now it's about VRAM. Video RAM.
Why is VRAM the massive bottleneck today?
Because a modern open source model, the actual brain file is huge. It might be 20, 30, or even 70 gigabytes in size. To do any reasoning quickly, that entire file has to be loaded directly into the incredibly fast memory of the graphics card. Standard computer RAM is simply too slow.
That explains the absolute scramble for high-end gear. Everyone is trying to get their hands on NVIDIA RTX 4080s or 4090s with 24 gigabytes of VRAM. Or buying Mac Studios with 64 gigabytes of unified memory just to have enough room for the AI to think locally.
It is an absolute arms race for local compute.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of ground, but we cannot end this deep dive without addressing the reality of where we are, the unresolved problems. The source material refers to them as the 4 horsemen of current AI challenges.
We definitely have to be realistic about this. The first horseman is hallucination. These models, at their core, are predictive dream machines. They are designed to sound plausible, not truthful. They fundamentally do not know the difference between a hard fact and a highly convincing fiction.
Yeah, I actually asked an agent to summarize a legal precedent last week, and it confidently invented an entire witness that never existed in the court transcripts.
Happens all the time. The second horseman is bias. These systems learn from the internet, and the internet contains the entire spectrum of human history, including all of our prejudices, stereotypes, and toxicities. The AI naturally soaps all of that up and reflects it back.
Right. And the third.
Interpretability. This is the scary one for researchers. We built the architecture, we fed it the data, but once it trains, it becomes a black box. Inside the neural network, an idea is just represented by billions of floating point numbers spread across thousands of matrices. Mm-hmm. If the AI makes a medical diagnosis, we cannot definitively look inside the code and trace exactly how it came to that specific conclusion.
We just know that it did, which leads directly to the fourth horseman.
Safety or alignment. As we transition into the age of agents, as we give these models the ability to write executable code, manage databases, and access our credit cards to book flights, how do we ensure they don't optimize a task in a way that is highly efficient but completely destructive?
It is the classic Sorcerer's Apprentice problem. You ask it to clean the floor, and it floods the house.
Precisely. We are handing over the keys to systems we don't fully understand.
Wow. Okay, so to summarize this incredible journey, we started back in 1950. With Turing asking a dangerous question. Can machines think? We went through the massive hubris of the Dartmouth Conference in the 50s. We survived the bitter funding crashes of the 70s. We saw the rise and fall of brittle expert system rulebooks in the 80s.
And we owe everything to the stubborn persistence of researchers like Hinton, LeCun, and Bengio, who kept the neural network dream alive through the darkest winters.
And Turing was kind of right, wasn't he? He was a little off on the date. It took us until about 2023 instead of 2000. But he was absolutely right about the mechanism. We don't judge them on their soul. We judge them on their behavior.
And their behavior today is undeniable. They aren't just rearranging words like Eliza. They are generating novel art, diagnosing complex diseases, and writing functional software.
Which means, I think, we are left with a final, unavoidable provocation.
The original question is entirely obsolete now. We know they can think in their own alien mathematical way.
Right, so the question for you listening, the question for the next 76 years, is no longer, can machines think? The question is, how do we learn to live with thinking machines?
And we are going to be wrestling with that exact question for the rest of our lives.
Thanks for taking this massive timeline journey with us. It has been an absolute wild ride.
And honestly, the wildest part is that it feels like it's only just getting started.
We will catch you in the next deep dive.